Well, hi, folks. I'm Tom Ivester, an alcoholic.
Hi, Tom.
And delighted to be here. Delighted to see you. Can't believe you how thrilled I am. The day before I left North Carolina, it was 78 degrees. And if you haven't been outside, I'll assure you it is not 78 degrees here. But I am glad to be here in the middle of a warm gathering of us. You saw a remarkable demonstration of our traditions here today, that we ought never be organized. But if we have to, we ought to do it right in the middle of the meeting. You know? I'm going to go at this as hard and fast as I can. I only got 3 hours. My God, it takes a lot longer than that. I'll go at it pretty hard and fast. It won't sound like it, but it will be. When you're from North Carolina, when you're going full speed, it sounds like slow motion. Let me get you to read one more thing, if you will. Just take a look at it. The theme of this conference, we absolutely insist on enjoying life. Yeah, I wanted to get that reading done because the work that was described in that writing of 1939 could be written today. Because we think that AA is widespread and all over the world, but don't kid yourself too much. There are vast regions of this country that don't have AA, and there are some that, anyway, we'll get into that, but the message applies, and the theme of this conference applies, because what the theme says is not that we enjoy entertainment or comedy clubs. We may enjoy those things, but what the theme is that we absolutely insist on enjoying life. And life is the stuff that we're in every day. And so the work that's described in that book, believe it or not, is where the joy of life really comes to life. And, some of those real frothy-sounding phrases like rocketed into a fourth dimension and all this kind of stuff, they sound like cotton candy until you get them hooked to where they come from. And where they come from is for that handful of folk that went to that town and got something started. And so that opportunity is still richly available here right now. And so I'm going to try to not only hold your interest with the history, but more importantly, I want to kind of invite you to the challenge of the work that we still have to do. Now, this will not be a history lesson. I love our history, but I'm not overly concerned with whether it was Thursday or Tuesday that Bill and Bob got together. Who cares? Yeah, I'm not a technician on history, so I'll probably use a lot of what do you call it, editorial license or something, and just wing it, you know. So don't take any of it to the bank. Go make bets on it. Other than what happened. So the history that's important to me is what happened. I want to do it in those three segments. I'm going to do it in those because Carol gets pretty tough if you don't do it exactly like she says to do it. So I'm going to do it in those three segments. And even though 3 hours seem like a long time, we won't really get through, but we'll visit those three areas, what we were like. I think that folks get me to do this because I'm rapidly becoming one of the few folk that can even recall faintly what those early days were like. Now, I wasn't there. I'm much too young for that. But but I am disturbingly close. If I make it for, what is this? This is a 15th. If I make it for 19 more days, I will celebrate my 48th year of continuous sobriety. Thank you very much. I kind of like, Al, I didn't mean to do that. I really didn't mean to stay here, but good God. If you're new, and I know some of you are, you better get out while you can, man. If you stay here too long, they got you, man. You'll never get out of here. And then after a while, you won't want to. I was really fortunate in the fact that I was 12-stepped by what I call the second wave of people coming into Alcoholics Anonymous. And when I look at the history, I can readily identify with the first 100. I knew a couple of them. Well, I knew several of them. And I can readily identify with them because they were my kind of drunks. I mean, they were people who lived like we did this meeting. They just sort of, let's get together and do something. We'll figure it out when we get there. And that was the way those guys were. They were, I say guys because we didn't get a woman until in the late 30s. I knew her. Yeah, she was a fine girl. A fine girl. And a treasure, too, my God, man. I'll tell you why in a minute, maybe. Now, we didn't have anything going. She was quite old when I got here. She probably 35 or so when I got here. But I'd have fit in with that bunch. Here was a bunch of folk that gathered up, and they just sort of hung out together. They didn't even have meetings like we do. They just hung out. You know, they hung out for a couple of years before they ever had a group. And so they just sort of huddled up like a sheep or something, you know, and they just kind of wandered around with each other. They had some visions, you know, of things that might be. I'm a right-handed drinker. I got, yeah. I lick with either tongue, though, I tell you that. So they were wonderful folk. Yeah, and they were following a program that other than some sort of, it almost sounded like a psychotic episode that Bill said when I first read it. He started talking about hearing stuff and wind blowing and stuff. Well, I felt like that a lot of times, but it was after a lot of drinking that I felt like that. But here's what they were following. No program design whatsoever, and they were just sort of hanging on to each other for dear life, literally. So I would have fell right into it. Absolutely no steps, no. We didn't have a purpose. I mean, we were just a gang of drunks. And so I'd have fit right in with that. Then they messed it up and started getting serious about it as they went along. But they were an amazing bunch. That whole story of our growth is just amazing to me. When you look at it and look at the unbelievable chain of events that happened, you know, where we came from, if you don't want to go way back in ancient history, with just the history we know names of, think about that Ebby. Now, I knew Ebby, not intimately, but I met him a few times, and he was an absolute poster boy for a slipper, and he lived up to the reputation. That's what he did. Yeah. And now here's Ebby, the town drunk in a little village in Vermont, and when he was captured the last time, I think he was shooting pigeons off his own house with a gun, and I don't do that in Vermont. And so they captured him, took him to court again. And there was a fella that went to court on some kind of a whim. He knew Ebby. And he said to the judge, "How about letting me have a chance with this guy?" It wasn't no program. He just said, "Let me see what I can do with this fella." So he took Ebby. And Ebby got struck sober for a while, at least enough to get out of court and get out of town. And that set up something that I may come back to this a little later on, but if you think about that, and when you think about the origin of Alcoholics Anonymous and think about some of the current dilemmas that we deal with today, you know, like one of the things is how we deal with people mandated to Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, how many places in this country, most, if I'm not aware of any except my community, I'll tell you why not maybe, where people come in with those little slips of paper that they got to get signed to prove that they were where they were supposed to be. Compare that to what happened with Ebby. Now, our fellowship originated from that kind of an action in terms of what led to us coming together. Because that fellow who was rescued from court came to New York and he was enjoying that sobriety. He's in some highly religious kind of a mode. And one day he decided to go see Bill Wilson, who was an old friend, and went to see him. And Bill said, "Whoopee, we drink." And Ebby said, "No, we don't." And so he was the guy who started to create a little bit of awareness and hope in Bill, I guess. Even though he couldn't tie it to anything except a heavier brand of religion than either one of them could stand very well. And so that's laid the seedbed for this thing. And then Bill got sober. And thank God for a guy named Bill Silkworth. You know, Bill, for my money, Bill Silkworth ought to be one of the founders if he was a drunk. Because that guy, imagine what kind of insight and awareness this guy had to have to take a guy who by any other measure would have sounded like he's hallucinating. Say, hey, Doc, I'm standing on a mountain and wind's blowing through me. What do you think you ought to do? He said, I think you ought to take another drink. That would normally have been the thing. But Silkworth was a different kind of man. I don't know why. But Silkworth said, man, I don't know what you got, but whatever it is, you better hang on to it, because it sure beats what you had. And so Bill walked away from that experience and that guidance from Silkworth, a changed man. And he had a conviction that was of himself and his God that said, I need to share this with other people. And with nothing more than that spiritual drive, he went back into that hospital and said, will you let me talk to these other people? Again, Silkworth took that giant step of faith and said, have at it. So he turned loose a guy that was a raving, wild alcoholic just a few months before and said, go get him, Tiger. And he did. And you know the rest of that story. He had very little success, except he kept being sober. Thank God for Al-Anon, eh? Didn't Beverly do a good job today? Man alive. I wish she'd take up drinking. We could use her today. She's a great gal. But thank God why I say that. Bill, you know, if you remember that thing at the end of 6 months, he said to Lois one day, man, this thing ain't working. Ain't nobody staying sober. We've got people trying to kill themselves here in the house. This thing is just no good. And Lois said those famous words. He said, Bill, you're still sober. Set up a principle that operates in this program today that we don't talk about much, but that you can't lose if you're doing this thing sincerely, trying to help somebody else, you can't lose. And then from that feeble beginning, Bill made his trip out to Akron and through that strange course of events that occurred in Akron, where he tried one last shot at his business and it went flat, and then I just tell this story because it means so much to me in terms of, I've been properly deferential. Normally in a workshop, I don't fly the flag because I don't feel like I'm working if I got the flag on. Paul wasn't going to work long, so he gets to wear the flag. Now, that's enough of the coat, too. I'll get uncomfortable tomorrow. What happened, Bill went through that deal and crashed and burned in Akron, and that was nothing new. Went into that old hotel. And in that story, I had a chance one time to, I took a chance, really. I was in Akron, and every time you go over there, people will show you that, take you that tour. If you haven't been, for God's sake, go. It's a wonderful tour to go back and walk back over that path that led to our being here today. And so this day I'm making the tour to the guy, and the guy said, you want to go to the Mayflower? And I said, yeah, but we can't go in there. People live there now. You know, it's not a hotel. It's some kind of a home for folk. And he said, come on, we'll go. And so he's enterprising drunk. He went over there. Somebody came out the door, and he grabbed the door. Simple enough. All right, let's go. And so we go in. And the book referred to the lobby is not the lobby. It's what we call the mezzanine is where that action occurred. So we go up on the mezzanine, and if you've been there, you know what I'm talking about. I mean, you can recognize a bar. I don't care if they put zebra skin over it or whatever. I mean, you can recognize a bar. There's just something about it that's built in. And so you can spot the bar over there. It's now some kind of an office, but it's still a bar. You can recognize it. And then the other side of the hall is that telephone setup over there. And when we went up there, you know how sometimes you just kind of, you visualize and relive or live something that's not really there. Well, that's what I was doing. I didn't think about it. I didn't plan to do that. But I started thinking about, you know, my God, it's no problem relating to it. I've done that 100 times, 1,000 times, where I was down to my last nothing and no way to turn. And I'm sitting there debating of whether to take a drink or not take a drink, and I always took a drink. But God knows I've been there. I know exactly how he felt. And the way he described that thing of pacing back and forth across that mezzanine floor. And sweating bullets. He can hear the gay sounds in the lounge. And God, what an enticing thing, eh? What an enticing thing. And then he makes that historic phone call to the folk, to the pastor listed over there on the deal, calls 10 people, and everybody's tied up doing something except the last guy. And he gets that last guy on the phone, and he says, I need one. And he says, hey, maybe we can find you one. He said a lot more than that, but I'm just kind of smooth. And then he put him in touch with the lady that put him in touch with Dr. Bob. And that wonderful moment, and I'm going through all of this, you know, while I'm sitting in there, watching that stuff in the hotel and just sort of picturing myself in that spot. And the thing that occurred to me, and has never left my mind, was what a slender, slender thread held the destiny of every one of us. Every one of us. Now, if he had turned the wrong way, maybe something else would have happened. We'll never know. But our destiny would have surely been different, no question about it. And so he took the turn, and then he wound up with Bob. And the decrepit broker sat down with the learned physician and talked to him about the hopelessness of alcoholism. Dr. Bob said something like, here I am listening, a layman telling me about an illness. And something happened. Something happened. Something monumentally important happened that day. Because what formed that day was the whole premise upon which we gather today. The whole premise upon which 2 million people walk under this flag today. And that premise was simply this. That when one alcoholic opens up and shares at a deep level with another alcoholic, it has a power never before witnessed in this world. And that's the heart and soul of everything we do in Alcoholics Anonymous. The most noble we ever become, I don't care how big we get or how many conventions we have, the most noble we ever become is when one alcoholic bridges that gap and reaches another alcoholic. And that's why this thing of this service is so important. And then that went on. They caught the bug. And then that each one reach one syndrome set in, and they raided another guy named Bill, and he was a hopeless case and knew it, and they gave him hope. He walked out never to drink again. Well, that I dwell on that just a little bit, because that foundation to me is critically important in all that we do. And I like to always keep that awareness about what a tenuous thing this is. This thing we call sobriety is a tenuous condition. We become tough as nails, but you can lose this sucker in a heartbeat. All you got to do is just change your mind. That's all. All you got to do is react instead of respond at the wrong time. All you got to do is let up just a crack in that spiritual defense that protects us. So I always like to remember the tenuous nature of what we have, and so that I want to take care of that. And so they are off and running. They started that sort of this kind of local gathering up, just like it was read about in that book, about going to that town and then finding somebody. They started finding people. They were fortunate. Yeah, I think Akron's probably the only city in the country where there's a hospital that still has that original ethic intact. I've gone on hospital visitation with people in Akron to see drunks in that hospital, just like they did 69 years ago. It's an amazing thing. Well, it's not so amazing. You know that old deal we say about ourselves, that if we do something once, it's a sacred tradition. So that's still a sacred tradition in Akron, and they continue to this day. And then they just grow slowly. Yeah, we refer to it as the first 100, but folks that I knew who were in that crowd, it never made a good 100 unless you counted on a remarkably good day. They were a gaggle of drunks is what it was. And a bold bunch of people. Now, my God, they had with just a handful of drunks, they had the gall to write this book that is held up now for God knows all these years, unchanged except for the minor stuff that has been done, just a couple of things. But there was the original program of recovery that was laid out. It has never changed since then, except minor little pronunciation stuff, English stuff. And so that's who they were. They must have been an arrogant bunch to say, gee, man, we really got something here. You know, right now, when this program formed and took shape, we have, according to those numbers, we probably have five times more members of Alcoholics Anonymous at the Holiday Inn right now. I mean, on, you know, paid up anyway. We got the money. I mean, that's the main thing. You can stay out there and please, but man, we got the money. We got five times probably more members than this when this came out. So here's this bunch. They put this out. They're thinking that it's going to hit the world, and they wanted to send it out to docks and stuff like that so we could conjure up more members. And so they printed the book real big so it looked fancy and expensive, and then they sent it out. And the hope was that the spark would catch somewhere. And I tell you something that was not a bad theory. I'll tell you how Alcoholics Anonymous, real headline style, how Alcoholics Anonymous started in my state, North Carolina. I wasn't there. It was a long time ago. But the there was a drug addict physician in Shelby, North Carolina, heard about the book because they sent the news out that it was there, and he ordered one. I don't know if it was a curiosity or thought it might help him or what, but he ordered one. When he looked at it, he knew it didn't apply to him. But he was a good man. Now, I never met him, but I met some of the first people that met in that town. And so he called in some guys and said, you ought to take a look at this thing. This might be helpful. And so that's how Alcoholics Anonymous actually started in North Carolina. First meeting we ever had, by the way, was interesting to me because I got a lot of interest in correction stuff. The first meeting was in a prison. There was exactly what that reading of. I'm fascinated by that thing of how we grow and what the concept of growth was. That there was a guy flying into the Charlotte airport, and if you ever flown U.S. Airways South, you probably had the pleasure of that airport. If you ever bought a ticket there, you won't buy another one. It's cheap. That's the most expensive airport in the country. And this guy was flying in one day, and he saw this prison. They're recognizable. And he had that thought that a new alcoholic would have. He said, I bet there's some drunks in there. And so when he landed, he went over to the prison. And he talked to the warden and said, you got any drunks here? The guy said, good God, yeah, man, we got a house full of them. And he said, can I talk to them? He said, go to it. And so he went in. That was the first AA meeting. It wasn't a meeting per se, but it was a meeting because there's one AA toting the message to folk whether they wanted to hear it or not. And that was the first meeting. There's now a group in that same prison. If you fly into Charlotte, you'll see it. It's still sitting there, sagging, but it's there. And so that was the way it got started. And so that concept started to catch on in a few places, very few. And then in 41, the thing that I want to really talk about is in that first 100, this kind of band of people, this tiny group of people. They started getting support from people. There were a lot of people who caught on, and thank God for the non-alcoholics who stabilized us. Thank God for the people who stabilized us. Because if we had run unattended, good God, man, we'd have probably been on Pluto by now. But we were guided by some extremely fine, fine leaders. And you could tick them off as well as me. Rockefeller, who when they went in to con him out of a whole bunch of money, Rockefeller said, don't you think money will screw this up? What a powerful principle came out of that. A lot of them. There were others. Think of the people. I mean, I guarantee you, in 2 minutes, we could name a lot of people. Sam Shoemaker and Ed Dowling and Sister Ignatia and who else that comes to mind? John Norris was in our board. Who? Yeah, yeah. Hey, Tebow. Yeah, oh boy, that surrender versus comply. Great, great friends that we had that really helped us enormously. Let me ask you one question. Let's jump that fast forward now. Those guys were about 65 years ago. Let's fast forward that a little bit. How about telling me some really prominent national figures that are proactive in terms of their support of Alcoholics Anonymous today? Just give me a few names. Who? She's one of us. I ain't talking about us. I mean, there's a lot of us. Yeah. Well, I mean to break her anonymity, but she does. So it's hard for me to break it. Who else? George Bush. Has he? Yeah. Any others? Any others? Huh? Who is he? Stephen Arrowsmith?
Stephen Tyler.
Oh, okay. Yeah, not us now. Yeah. Well, I think the point's made. The point's made that if you think back, we had tons of people. Today, they are extremely hard to find. And it's not because they've grown to hate us. We'll talk a little bit more about that. But I think it's kind of a significant thing. But so we had support. We had people who caught the vision. We had some people who saw it better than we did, who helped us sort of stay the course and not get screwed up. So we started sending the word out all over the world that we got a solution here, man. We got a solution. That's why I wanted Lynn to read that part in there, because what it's talking about is when this word gets out, who's going to answer the mail? You got about 40 or 50 people on a good day. Suppose we got the word out in this hotel that we've got the solution here, and then we're going to send out the word tomorrow to the world. Now, how would we respond? You think of what we would have to do to contend with that. And so what happened was exactly what's described in that book, and like that guy at the airport in Charlotte that went into that prison, that people started frantic calls. There's a guy named Jack Alexander wrote an article, one of our several early publications, but his was one, a real landmark publication in the Saturday Evening Post, describing Alcoholics Anonymous. And we jumped from 40 or 50 or even say 100, even though that's kind of a generous count. But we jumped from that to 8,000 almost overnight. 8,000. And you just picture the frantic calls for help that we're going in three cities. We got New York and Akron and Cleveland. And that's it. And we got calls, and man, it takes you a week to get to Arizona. I mean, unless you go to, well, you just can't get there hardly. So how do you deal with it? And the stories that go with that are just absolutely fascinating to me. Just fascinating. I was looking at archives in Missouri a while back, and there was a group. It tells how the groups founded, where they met. The first group in Missouri, the meeting place was a car. They met in a car parked on the street. And what happened, it makes sense when you understand the story. They were driving from Springfield to Kansas City to a meeting. And they had five. Sometimes they'd have more people driving down than were in the meeting in Kansas City. And finally, the brilliant alcoholic mind caught on and said, "Why are we driving to Kansas City?" So they met in the car. So there's amazing stories that happened to this thing. And the thing that's really important to me is to think about that in terms of really what happened. Because aside from some sort of heroic things that happened, you can bet that everywhere that Alcoholics Anonymous started to exist was because somebody said, "Let it start here." Somebody said, "Let it start here." And they took the stand and planted the flag and said, "We're going to do it here." And just there were lots of people who did that. As a matter of fact, I had the uncanny privilege of doing something similar to that, and I can tell you that it's a very great place to get through, but it's a tough place to be. But that's how we grew. And I never like to take our, it wasn't corporate marketing and sending out reps and support groups and all that. These were alcoholics who had a wisp of hope, and they stood the ground, and they held the place till help got there. And so it brought a certain kind of a quality in the program that was just something to behold. Yeah, we okay. We okay. I want to make sure. Will you watch me at 3:15?
Sure. Will.
Yeah. Okay. Great. I know she will.
I will.
We got to get this girl some Ritalin or something. No, you keep that spirit, boy. I tell you, that's valuable. And, I tell you that no extra charge, Chris. I'm gonna throw it in anyway about how I came to be in the position of it almost exactly where those people were planting it in Yuma. You know, some of y'all know that I did a little bit of I guess you could call it Peace Corps work in the penitentiary. Well, that'd be one way to put it. It wouldn't have anything to do with the reality, but we'll talk about that tomorrow. But today, when I got out, yeah, I belonged to an excellent group. Yeah, I was in the neighboring state up in Michigan. I was in a great group. And when I left, I was a pretty solid member of AA. I was sober 3.5 years and very, very active. I was active in every legacy of service that we have. And so when I hit the ground, man, I'm exuberant. Yeah, I know where I'm going. I got my stuff lined up. I go to my first meeting at what was logically to be my home group, and I'm telling you, that was the worst meeting I've ever been to in my life. I mean, that sucker stunk. I never been to a meeting that bad in my life. If we'd had one that bad in prison, somebody would have got wounded. I promise you that. And I thought, Jesus, is this it? Is that what this is? And I mean, I wasn't used to this, man. I was still trying to get back from the fast lane anyway, you know. And man, I walk in there, and I am in Mudville. And I thought, Jesus. Yeah, I was 22 miles from the city, Charlotte. And I said, I'm going to go over there where there's some action. Then a disturbing thought occurred to me. I'm the second oldest guy in town. The only other guy standing, senior to me, was over the hill. I mean, he'd just been here, he hadn't been here long, but he was old. And the poor boy he gave everything he had, but he just had used up a lot of it. And so he was fighting, and I thought, God knows. Well, disturbing question was, when do you become responsible? Yeah, when do you grow up? When do you take a stand? Yeah. Yeah, you're not going to be entertained and partied all the time. You know, at what time do you take a stand? And so, I decided when I thought about it, it was not a difficult decision. So I had the experience. It's a valuable experience of literally starting AA in a fairly large city. And I tell you one reason I was talking about appreciating that woman when the first woman came in AA. I was the only guy. Even with the newer ones, I was the only single guy around, and young, and a pretty little boy too. And we didn't have a woman member. I mean, nowhere. You know, it was way off somewhere. And so I started after I got real active in the program. I started getting some calls. And if you're the only visible sign of life, you know where the calls are going. And so I started getting calls. I made one call on a woman by myself, and I found out why the guys that had introduced me to AA had been so adamant about boys work with boys and girls work with girls. And so I got through that okay, and no harm done to either party. And and no hanky-panky done to either party. You can go to bank on that. Man, those people had me so brainwashed, I'd have rather French kissed a cobra I mean, that, it just didn't do that. I mean, a guy told me that women in AA are alcoholics. They're not women. You forget it. And so I did. I made that one and had a great learning experience. And I never went on another one without a woman. Not a one. Now, there weren't any women to take, but there's always an avenue. My mother has been on more 12-step calls than most members. And that's a fact. My girlfriends would go. I mean, I'd pick up a hitchhiker. I'm going to take somebody. There's somebody going with me. And it was a great, great, great kind of an experience. There was a woman moved. I would like to say she got sober there, but she didn't. She moved in from California. Slick, quick, articulate, 10 years sober. And I said, darling, you're mine. You are mine. If I grabbed that girl. And she's still there. You know, she's a. I sponsored two women. She's one of them, because I was the only thing around to sponsor her then. And I'm not gonna get rid of her now that she's geriatric. And then I got another one that a guy left me in a will, and that just doesn't seem American to do. I can't do anything to him. He's dead, and there she is, and so. Trying to figure out how to, I'm not going to die to get rid of her, but I'll figure out some way with, anyway. But that was how I wound up in that position. And so those were great times. And they, in a way, yeah, let me tell you what they were like. And you can read about it in the book, but maybe I can help bring it to life a little bit. But what were we like? Well, you've seen some of it. We were kind of a happening more than a movement. We were a happening. We were just sort of coming together hither and yon, and everybody was just flying around by the seat of their pants. It wasn't a whole bunch of structure or anything. We were just sort of going at it. Didn't know what we were doing. You know, there's sort of and in all honesty, it's more of a myth than a fact, that after that first intensive group of people who did a lot of head-on work with each other, when that dam broke and we started getting flooded with drunks, I guarantee you there wasn't much studying and theorizing and think tanking and workshops and seminars. They just didn't exist. Now I'm lucky to get 12-step calls in a year. I've had three at a time. You know, never mind in a year, three at a time. So they were wild and woolly days. They were exciting days. They were demanding days. They thank God I was young. And so they were active days. It was a small and intimate thing. You know, as we started to grow, it was naturally small. And as little towns started to develop group, we just what she read, we create the fellowship we crave, eh? And so what we did is a lot of visitation back and forth. We'd get the flag planted somewhere, and we'd all just kind of rally to support and steady it, and you know, help them get going. And so it started to grow. Wonderful, wonderful experience in that. A lot of fellowship things. We had a tremendous number of speaker meetings. And my own personal, it's not a bias, it's a standard, really, that I like a balance, an even balance between open speaker meetings and closed discussion meetings. Because I think it's a great place for getting down to brass tacks with other alcoholics, period. But there's also an enormous place for open speaker meetings where we instead of sitting around thinking about ourselves, we give our hopefully undivided attention to somebody else. And we cry with somebody if it's the time. Or we rejoice with people. Wonderful, wonderful experience. It's also a great time to get family involved and friends. Now, I'm always struck. It's just weird. I don't mean to editorialize much, but just a little. I'm always struck by we do lip service to this family illness thing, but if you look at how we reflect that in our strategies of recovery, we darn near ignore it. Yeah, I tell you something. If you want to really get something to at least causes me question. We are as sensitive and sympathetic and darn near maudlin about kids as anybody I know. I mean, I don't know of anybody that gets more emotionally wrought over kids than us. Next time you go to a conference and they have an Alateen meeting, watch how we act on that feeling. Watch how we reach out to kids in trouble. Watch how we reach out to kids who are hurt, who are lost, who are struggling. And we darn near stonewall them. We darn near stonewall. I don't want to understand it, but it just is beyond me. I cannot fathom why we like that. It's just a whole different. That value of open speaker meetings is so that the family can participate in family recovery. That's tremendously important. That was an editorial, pure and simple. The stuff, if you want to really follow the script for what I'm going to talk about for this last 10 minutes, turn in the text to page 97 and you'll see it, because there's a paragraph in there that says all of the stuff that can happen. You believe me, that is not theory. There is nothing on that page where it talks about all the stuff of getting ripped off furniture, burned, you know, insulted, hurt, fight, get all that stuff. There's not a single thing on there that hadn't happened with me much more than one time. And so those were very real times. And they were adventure sometimes. At 3 a.m. and phone calls, I answered them, but I guarantee you I didn't like them. Not at all. I mean, that phone would ring, and I'd say, oh, Jesus, don't you ever do anything during duty hours? And then it answered the phone. And they're not your people that talk about yearning for the good old days. I guarantee you they either weren't there or have very poor memories, one or the other. They'll thump it up on those good old days. So those kind of things, they were just characteristic. That I'll tell you about one that some of them are kind of enjoyable after they're over. There was a I got a call. It's the first time I ever got one from a high roller executive type. And I was kind of excited because I was working in a mill sweeping the floor on the night shift. And so I was kind of excited that the big cheese of an industry was calling for help from moi. And so I got on my charger and went. And, you know, people have a lot of motives for why they call. He had a rather domineering wife, and she wouldn't let him drink. So he called me. He didn't know me, but he called me because he figured I was his ticket to drink. Well, yeah, I messed with him till 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning. Then. And then finally, now my rule of thumb was and is, I won't buy a guy a drink till I'm sure I can't help him. And if I'm sure I can't help him, I might buy him one. And so this high roller dude was just beating on me, wanting to buy a drink, and I finally recognized that it was a hopeless guy. I said, all right, tell me your favorite bootlegger. Now, I thought I'd drunk at everyone in the county, but he took me to one. I think even I wouldn't have drunk that. Probably, but I wouldn't go. It was a real pigsty is what it was. And so we go in there, and I'm looking at that thing, and so we go in, he orders his stuff. It ain't never seen a refinery or distillery or whatever you call that. It looked like what it was. Somebody made that out in the backyard or something. And about that time, the lights started flashing all around that bootleg joint. They'd never raided. We had 500 bootleggers in that county. They raided that night. And so here they come, the goon squad coming in. Ain't nobody there to fight, you know. I mean, they're just laying around, so they're dragging drunk. And I know this one cop kept looking at me. He got standing over a young Ivy League looking guy sitting there. And so he came over to me. He said, what are you doing here? I said, man, you wouldn't believe it. And he said, well, try it out. And I told him. And he said, well, I'll be damned. I haven't ever heard of that. And And from then on, I'm telling you one thing. You talk about putting your phone number on the telephone booth wall. I mean, that sucker gave everybody my phone number. And every time they had anybody acting up anywhere, in jail, kicking out bars or whatever, my phone rang the police department. We need you up here, man. They gave me hell. But what a thrill, eh? What a growing experience. Yeah. So they're great adventures, you know, when you look back. And they're an enormously important thing. Few to no resources back in those times. Yeah, I hear people today, it's almost just like part of the language, treatment or detox or hospitals. It would not have been part of the language if you lived in North Carolina. St. Thomas in Akron? Yeah, St. Thomas was the notable, truly notable exception. If you'd have tried to put an alcoholic in a hospital in North Carolina, they'd have put you in jail. I mean, you couldn't get an alcoholic in there on a bet. I mean, if a guy had lots of bucks and he could bribe somebody into what they always diagnosed him was gastrointestinal disturbance. Well, of course you got that. And so they'd get in on that. But, I mean, you're putting a drunk in there, you can thump it up. And then we finally got to a point that we started being able to get folk in literally. We had to provide babysitter service. They called it something else, but that's what it was. Because back then they weren't going to let their staff get victimized by the patients. The attitude about alcoholics back then was, I mean, purely bad. It was not an illness. It was a moral issue. And that was not even up for discussion during that period. And so when we finally got it, we had to provide service. I know one night we had a guy in there, and it was my time. We'd do a shift just like we worked there. And I went in to do my shift, and I relieved the guy coming out the door. And I said, "How's he doing?" He said, "Oh, he's good." Yeah. So I went in. Now we're on the fifth floor, and the window's only about that wide. No drunk. And I said, "Where did that fool go? I mean, my God, man, just left him." You know, so I'm down on my knees looking under the bed and shaking the blankets and all this kind of stuff, looking in the bathroom, looking down at the floor in case he got out. And then I heard a little commotion. You know those wall locker type things, a metal wall? I went over and opened the door. Well, he was only slightly confused. He thought he was standing at the urinal, and I opened that door, and he looked at me real indignant. He said, "I beg your pardon." I said, "Pardon my ass. Get out of here. What the?" Well, anyway, they fought later, I'll assure you. But those were just routine kinds of things. So there were no resources. We had one doc in the county. Thank God for that man. But to get any kind of service for him, what you got was a shot in the rump. And you literally had to go around to the back door of his house, just like going to a bootlegger. And he would give him the shot in the rump in his kitchen. And he'd write a little prescription for some don't quiver pills or something. And that was it. I mean, that's sum total. And I tell you, I've never gone through treatment or detox, unless you call jail detox, but I've never been through any kind of a program. But I'm truly thankful for it. If you've ever had the experience that I've had of, I literally had a guy die drunk in my arms one time, and I had nowhere to take him, nowhere. And if you do that, it will sensitize you heavily. Toward having access to resources. So that was the good old days. And sobering up was done at home a lot. Yeah, my family did a lot of sobering up, man. We've put more people through DTs. I'll tell you one, then I'll quit on this thing for this part because she's going to hurt me. I had a guy that... He was a real high-bottom type of drunk. His so-called drink of choice was bay rum shaving lotion. I mean, if he had money, that's what he drank. And I got so tired of sobering that guy up on that stuff. And he'd get, yeah, but he's just regular. So I 12-stepped him one day, and he was out of his gourd and needing a drink bad. I said, all right, come on. I took him to my home and sat him in a rocking chair in my front yard. Now, I don't recommend this to anybody. I wouldn't even recommend it to me, but I just didn't know anybody. And I went to his place where he bought this stuff and bought a case, not a few bottles, a case of Bayram shaving lotion. And I got back with that stuff, and he said, you got it? I said, you bet I got it. I said, buddy, we're going to drink some shaving lotion. And I sat there, and every time he'd finish one, I'd have one waiting. And he finally got enough, thought he was on the moon. And I said, no, 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 baby. We're going to drink some shaving lotion. I fed that sucker shaving lotion until he went in a coma. And I know that now. I just thought that was a signal he had enough. And but my God, do you realize how dangerous that was? Man, I could have killed that sucker in a heartbeat. And I'd like to tell you, it turned him against Bayram. It did for about 9 months. I was banking on that, but then he's right back. I mean, it's a powerful darned illness that we've got here. Oh, wait, I'm not quite there yet.
You're okay.
Am I? Okay. All right. Well, I'll finish up one more. No, I tell you what. I show you I'm a good guy with a heart in the right place. I'll go ahead. This is a good break point. That's the point. All right. What are we going to take? 15 minutes?
15 minutes.
Come on back because it's going to be good stuff. We'll get it up to where we were for sometime here before too long. Well, you got a good picture of that thing. Al just asked me a question. I'll just throw it out there now that one of the very few advantages of being old, in addition to Medicare, is that I had the opportunity to meet Bill Wilson. And it was an opportunity, but we had the International Toronto at 65, and somehow I just had the notion that it was going to be my only chance, and it turned out to be so. And so I went, and I was broke, but I went anyway, and had the great, I saw him a lot of times, you know, in big meetings and all that stuff, but had one really valuable time when we had a traditions deal. So you can count on a fairly small, intimate crowd when you get into traditions. And so we said just 35 of us, and we sat down and talked and just about traditions. Now, I didn't want to tell him anything. I just wanted to touch him, I think, you know, just to make sure he's there. And that was just a great experience and had obviously a lot of personal value for me. So we were rocking along, and the character of the program started to change. And I'll tell you in front that I think some of the changes were sublimely important and valuable, and some were difficult, and some have created some real difficulties in the fellowship. And so it'll be a little bit of both. I'm not a prophet of gloom, you know, but I'm not the village idiot either, you know, so I've got some stuff that I am troubled with, and I hope you do too. And so I'm going to invite you. It's when you start trying to get people into something, the first thing that you need to know is, well, what are you fixing? You know, what are we about here? You know, just rushing about doing good things is nice, but that's sort of pabulum stuff. And so you got to connect. It's like when somebody tells their story. If you let somebody start talking and don't do any drinking before he starts telling his story, your drunks won't listen. I mean, they just flat won't listen. You know, you got to connect, you know, like Bill and Bob did, and then drunks will listen. But if you start just preaching instead of sharing, you can thump it up. You can flat thump it up. So, so some changes started to occur. Some of these, most of that, I'm sort of a student of that first, but a little bit I was a participant, but some of this stuff started to occur about the time I got here. The opening the door to the idea that alcoholism might be more than just a bad habit or worthless behavior started to emerge a little bit. There were always people in sympathy with it, but they weren't in any real leadership kind of roles. There were people that just sort of sympathy. There's always been people who loved ugly dogs. And like that old doc in my town, yeah, he took that on his own to do that through the back door. And right about the time I came in, somewhere thereabouts, it didn't have anything to do with my coming in, but the American Medical Association kind of nodded toward alcoholism as an illness. Sometimes we say they declared it an illness. That's just not so. What they did was acknowledge it as being like an illness, you know. But whatever they did was enough to start softening that rigid attitude that the medical profession had about dealing with drunks. It opened that door and said, wait a minute, this is not just jail treatable. This might very well be a valid area of responsibility for us. And so that was a little crack, but it was an important crack. And it happened right about the time that I got here. That thing I described in the hospital with that, some of that goofy stuff in the hospital was product of that, you know, that where these things started to get out on Main Street a little bit, and it started to get in. Boy, I'm telling you, it was absolutely manna from heaven when that started to come about. I'll tell you where the manna turned into gold was in when insurance companies got the message. And the whole notion of dealing with alcoholism as an illness, talk about a growth industry, it really started to open the doors. If you want to see people get dedicated, make some money in it. And that's what happened, you know, that all at once some people became extremely zealous about making the treatment of alcoholism available. And I tell you, that's a double-edged sword, though, that when you get that. I'll give you this one little example that maybe undergird a little bit of a principle. It's not an axiom, but it's a little bit of a principle you can play with. Beverly, the Al-Anon speaker, I was just out in that country. She's talking about in Utah. And I visited a little facility. And it's one of every community just about has one. It's sort of a place where you can take drunks and get them, you know, sort of off the street and possibly help. And so they took me up to a place in outside of Ogden called Valley Camp. And beautiful place. Jesus, just lovely. I could stay there if the beds weren't so bad. But it's just a beautiful place. And I sat down while I was there, and we had a meeting with the guys that were staying there. And in the course of it, one of the things that they valued was that they had been there 54 years, oldest facility in Utah. And in 54 years, they had never taken 1 cent from any public source, not 1 cent of insurance, of tax, of anything. The principle that we use in AA of self-supporting through our own contributions was adopted there. And so I sort of went around, and when I left, I had 3 or 4 guys that were out the car sending me off, and I said, now I want you guys to do one thing for me. And he said, what? I said, if anybody offers you any money, knock them out. And one big old guy said, you got it, Captain. You got it. Well, there's an important principle in that whole business, and why this thing of differentiating what we do from what others do is critically, critically important. And so when treatment started to come into being, that had some real kind of troubling aspects to it that we dealt with sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly, sometimes well, and sometimes poorly. And what I want to talk about on that, I tell you in front that I am not criticizing anybody, nobody. If there's any criticism, I would criticize us more than anybody else, but I'm not criticizing anybody. I'll just tell you in terms of what happened. You know, when you look at the development of our fellowship, what happened that impacted what we do and how we do it. And so... We started to open up a little bit with the hospital, with the insurance thing, with treatment. Your treatment started to emerge. Now, there was a little bit, I'd heard faint stuff, a little bit like the Hazelden deal. That thing was started a long, long time ago, long before the treatment industry grew. It was started by a bunch of A folk, just like the folk in Utah, that said, we need a place for drunks. And that now has become the preeminent place on the planet, you know. So it was there, that little 24-hour day book that we bootlegged around for years before we still bootlegged some. It never was an actual AA document, but it was done by some of the guys that did that thing at Hazelden. That was there. But beyond that, there weren't that many places that the. We had one in North Carolina. I took an awful lot of drunks over there when I learned about it and then started to have at least enough money to do it. We had a place in Charlotte called Wilmuth, W-I-L-M-I-T-H. You think about it, where do you suppose that name came from? Yeah, Bill and Bob. And Wilmuth, Wilson Smith. And it was AA guys, you know, and they recognized that sobering people up at your house is not fun. And it's a little rough on the family when you're wrestling a drunk at your own house. And just like I said, nothing in that book that I haven't experienced, including burning the furniture and wrecking the furniture and fighting somebody. And so that gets a little testy in your house. So when I learned that there was a place for $75, I could take somebody over there. And they'd do that for me, and let them break their furniture. And what they did was not treatment by any stretch of the imagination, unless you count training people how to tell time as treatment. Because what they did was, on a time standard, they rationed decreasing amounts of booze. We call it tapering off. And so what you do is take somebody in there crazy drunk and 3 days later pick him up. And a guy looked like the Pope. Well, almost. But if you don't think a drunk can tell time, if they're supposed to drink at 9 o'clock, I'll guarantee you at 9 o'clock somebody's out there picking up. Hey, you see what happened? Drink time. And so those were valuable places. You know, they were useful places. All it was short-term stuff, but it at least started to provide some services around different people. Wait just 1 minute. Oh, God, I'm in the root section. I just finished. I thought that looked so familiar. And so when these things started to emerge, there's two ways to deal with something. You can either react to it or respond to it. And so when treatment came into being, just like I just described, there was some, you know, real positive response. That was a good thing, you know, and had absolutely no qualms about it. And then when insurance started paying, it started to get a little bit more downtown in style and quality of care. Things started to change a little bit. And for some reason, we started to develop, and I just say we globally. I mean, certainly there were some people that were strong, strong advocates and remained that way forever. But we generally started to get a little troubled by this emerging thing called treatment. Because when it caught on, I mean, once it started, it spread like wildfire. When there started to be money available, my God, man, it just cropped up everywhere, and so we didn't react too well. I think one of the real things that we failed to do was, and I hear it to this day, was that we failed to recognize that our work hadn't changed, the portal of entry changed, the point from which they come. Change. Not. They still come from the same place. But when treatment came in, we drifted into some sort of a myth that emerged along with treatment, that magic was done in those 30 days so that folks would go forth and sin no more. Well, you know better than that. But it got overrated in terms of what would happen. And you started to hear stuff like, well, treatment is equivalent to 1 to 5 years of recovery in AA. Well, you know better than that. But that sounds good. You know, that sounds real good. And so what we started seeing, rather than wrestling drunks and all this kind of stuff and going getting them and all the fire alarms and all that, what we started seeing was people disappear from the community and they'd come back real nice, smelling good, talking good, probably more conversant with the things about AA than a lot of us. You know, they learn the language. If you sit there for 28 days and study, you're going to learn some stuff. And so we overrated that a bit. And you right away thought these folks are healed rather than recognizing what I believe to be an absolute truth, that when somebody goes through the treatment center and they come into AA, they're a brand new member of AA. They have zero real awareness about how to function as a member of AA. They know how to function as a patient in a care situation. But there is a huge, huge gap between that womb of treatment and the battle that you have to do to maintain this thing. I personally believe, doesn't make it right, but I personally believe that when we get sober, we have to be prepared for the fight of our lives. And if we're not, we're probably going to get knocked out. And if we don't see it in that kind of urgency, and so when treatment started to emerge, that started to change a little bit. And I feel this may not make a lot of sense. Phil celebrates 30 days today. Yeah. 30 days. I don't mean to put your business on the street, but I just wanted to brag on you a little bit. I don't expect this to make a lot of sense to you. Just be tolerant of old people that babble in a strange language. So it took some getting used to, is the long and short of it. And so we were grappling with, and you started hearing stuff like, well, they're doing our work. There's nothing left for us to do. You know, they're doing our 12-step work. And then after it said a little bit more, you started hearing kind of angry tones to that. These people are doing our work, getting paid for it. A lot of recovered people were hired into that profession, you know, who had some qualifications. They would get, and some who didn't, would get hired into that profession. And that really created a lot of rumblings in the fellowship. You know, and it really looked like we were hiring 12-step work to be done. And so that was very troubling. And so there was an undercurrent of negativity that started to come in. We started to get, sometimes, most times, politely, but often not politely, resentful toward the whole deal. And not being able to fight the corporate out level. Strangely enough, I think, we started to take it out a bit on the client. We started to take it out a bit on the patient. We started to develop some negativity about that whole experience and the person who had it. I'll tell you what I'm talking about. And some of it was practical. Some of it was not so. It created some huge problems, you know, because you know, I just described about you know, by now they're shaping up a little bit, but the groups are still very often small and few members. I had a guy in my community call me one time, and I knew him. I had worked with him when he first came in, and he said, "Tom, I got a real problem. I want to ask you. I'd go for it." So he said they had just started a new group. They called it the newcomer group. Well, my God, man, that's the anthem for what folks in the treatment industry think they need from AA is a newcomer group. That's what they're dealing with. And so when that word got out, you had five guys in this group. And one night, a bus drove up with 45 people on the bus. So he called me. He said, "What are we going to do?" I said, "Well, when you go to bed tonight, thank God for sending you all those drunks." He said, "I know that, but how are we going to buy coffee?" I mean, come on, guy, get real. How are we going to buy coffee? How are we going to take care of these folks? Now, those are real problems, real problems. And so you started to get some of that where you're getting this sense of overwhelming, this sense of not being personally involved in it. All at once, you got folk in the treatment industry got a little generous with who they would load on the bus. And so we started getting a lot of people with multi-addictions, sometimes with addictions that were not alcohol. And so you started getting a lot of a mixed bag coming in. And so there were a lot of things that started to go on that started to get kind of a climate of negativity about this whole experience. And so rather than recognizing, you know, what's coming in the door, we started reacting to it. We started reacting to it. I had a guy, 33 years sober, that came over to me one night, and he wanted to say something about people coming in from treatment center. And I said, "Yeah, isn't it great?" And he said, "No, it's not great." And I said, "Why?" And he said, "Well, you know they're not sincere." Come on, God. Yeah, how irrelevant can it possibly be to an alcoholic in crisis? Sincerity, I mean, my God, that's a way down the road. How about survival, you know? But I mean, it's just symptomatic of what I'm talking about. And so there was some real troubling kind of stuff that started to come out of that. And I really don't think we handled that very well. And still don't now. The problem is solving itself because there appears to be, or not appears to be, there is a marked decline in the ready availability of treatment. This is a little bit of an outside issue, but I'll throw it in. But I work with a lot of people, and I don't hesitate to recommend treatment. I recommend treatment if somebody can't stay sober on the street. That's the only criteria I use. If they can't stay sober on the street, then I will. I don't send them or recommend it for rarefied treatment. I say if you can't stay sober on the street, then you might need to do that. Otherwise, I'm more inclined to work with them locally. But in the entire state of North Carolina, there are only three places that I will personally recommend. And because a lot of them have really drifted into some things that are pretty foreign to a fundamental basic treatment deal. And so if somebody gets off into, and I understand that a lot of them have to do this stuff because they don't have multiple diagnoses, they can't get reimbursement from insurance. I understand that. I just don't accept it. And, you know, it's for me, and I don't mean to editorialize too much about that, but I don't get casual about that because a diagnosis is a lifetime scar. And that sucker is recorded somewhere. And I don't want to be tagging somebody as being clinically depressed or something when he's hung over. I mean, God knows, that's just part of the territory. So lots of things. There's a real problem that comes out, and still we deal with, having to do with people who are medicated significantly when they come out of treatment, and we very often have to deal with, if we're going to try to work with folk, how to responsibly help folks deal with that problem. I just tell you my own personal thing about that. It certainly is not party line, but it's mine. I think it's a tremendously dangerous thing to deal with if I try to do it in a heavy-handed manner. And I say that because I know places in this country where there's an ethic set in that if you take medication, then your sobriety date must change, and that's done in a dictatorial style, and I just flat disagree. Because that's dangerous. I have not participated in, but I've been emotionally connected to too many suicides that came from some kind of meathead handling or something like that. That it's just one of those things difficult. So if I get somebody, what I always try to get across to them is to get off of it if you can. And the way to do that is to meet with your physician and see if you can realistically set a goal for when you can get off. If I go beyond that, I got an idiot in control of my life. Because when I'm going to step in and overrule medical authority, I am absolutely off my rocker. And I'm just not going to do that. So I think it's a serious thing in that there's a lot of jeopardy involved if we don't handle it right. So lots of things that come out of there. That kind of hardening attitude. One reason I wanted to do this thing here, we absolutely insist on enjoying life, and the fact that the work is coupled to it. You know that in, if you really want to, if you, it's like this convention, for example, this conference. This is here to enjoy. You know, now this is not bedrock AA. This is a celebration. You know, it's called what? Pockets of Enthusiasm. This is a generator. This is a motivator. This is a sparkerator or whatever. You know, what we want to do here is build up some spirit. And I'll let you in on a little secret that you may already know about. A conference can be one of the loneliest places in all of Alcoholics Anonymous. I mean, it can be excruciatingly lonely. Because if you look around here and hear all this whoopee and hugging and smacky poo and all this kind of stuff, I guarantee you everybody here ain't doing that. And so if you really want to get into the juices that generate the enthusiasm, insist on it. How do we do it? We get in it. You get in that. Be the one handing out the dum-dums. I thought he was calling my name when he said dum-dum. Yeah, the chairs, you know, all that kind of stuff. You know, that's the stuff that produces the joy, you know. And so that hardened attitude, you know, I honestly believe that we're folks who cannot afford to have a hardened attitude when it comes to other alcoholics. One thing I say, and I'm just telling you my good stuff. I'm not going to tell you stuff I do bad. But I'll tell you one thing I'm good at is I welcome folks to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I flat do that. I welcome people to their own home group sometimes. You go into some that just look like everybody's dead or comatose or something. And so I don't hesitate one bit to welcome people to AA. Because I think it's just tremendously important. So every person, my commitment is that every person that I meet coming into Alcoholics Anonymous, just like Phil, yeah, I'd say to Phil if I get a chance to talk, well, I got a chance to talk to him, that my trying to help you with that, well, let me start over. That if somebody says to me, I appreciate what you're doing, I said, let me tell you one thing, that my helping you will mean more to me than it will to you. I need you more than you need me. Now, if I say that to you, Phil, that's going to sound like a bunch of junk right now. You know, why would I need? I'm a 48-year guy. What do I need with a 30-day guy? Because you're the lifeblood. Excuse me. You're the lifeblood of AA. And if I get to a point that I'm cynical about the people coming into AA and I get a hardened attitude, and my attitude is just to say, and meet you and don't even look at you. You know, that's a hardened attitude. And so if I recognize that I need you more than you need me, I got a good shot at staying here. And I've got a good shot at making you welcome. And so it's what we're about. We're not do-gooders doing good work. We're people who go right back to what I was talking about with Bill and Bob. We need each other. We don't have to love each other. We don't have to like each other. We just have to love each other at a deep level. And so that's an important kind of thing. And that hardened attitude that comes with this real quick put-down type of response about everything that's geared to help alcoholics, I think it's very hurtful to AA and readily available. And so that's why I'm dwelling on that just a little bit, because I just don't think we can afford to have that. And it doesn't mean we roll over for everything walking in the door, but it means that we need to never get so hardened that we're not sensitive to the folk who walk in. And it doesn't mean we roll over everything walking in the door, but it means that we need to never get so hardened that we're not sensitive to the folk who walk in. And that's my whole point in that one. Thank you very much. I thought she was a tough dictator, but she's really a gentle person. She gave me a cough. I don't let that get around, Carol. Thank you. Thank you very much. All of this stuff kind of comes together over time. You see a decrease. I was just talking with Jerry about that. You see that sort of product of what we're talking about, a decrease in active work outside the group. I won't visit this too much, but one of the things that started to become part of our fiber, you know, when this treatment influx started to happen, we started to see some changes in how we do meetings. We started to drift, and I mean, like I say, I'm not criticizing how people do treatment. What I'm criticizing is how we perpetuate that process, because what we've drifted into is an unbelievable proliferation of meetings that have little to no structure, and where the focus of the meeting is whatever happens within the hour that it gathers. Nothing else. Absolutely nothing else. It's a group of people, probably good folks, who meet for good reason. But it has no history, no life that precedes the meeting, nor any that follows. You know, it's an experience that's confined to 1 hour. You know. And so while it may do little harm, it's a kind of a shaky place for us to rapidly move. And the movement is in that direction. I mean preponderantly in that direction. Right all over the country. You know, not just in North Carolina or Cincinnati, but it's all over the country. And it's understandable, because it's, in all honesty, I think it's the easier, softer way. And it's attractive, because it's almost a no-brainer. If you look at the construct of a meeting, my God, they can almost be spontaneous, and often are spontaneous. You know, like we were doing a little spontaneous planning, but we were modifying a plan, not making up one. We knew what we were going to be doing here. I knew what my topic was. I just forgot it for a while, but the boss lady reminded me, said, you better not be talking about relationships. You better. our drift overwhelmingly is toward that. I tell you this, of all the things that I'm concerned about in Alcoholics Anonymous, that's my number one. My number one is that absolutely exponential growth of those little lightweight meetings and the demise of strong, well-ordered, purposeful groups. That is my single number one greatest concern in AA. And it's not just because of bias about quality of meetings. I think that probably is obvious. It's if we drift into a preponderance of just lightweight meetings, where does leadership come from? Where does a group conscience form? You can't have a meeting conscience. That's like a meeting conscience in a bus station or the airport tomorrow. Yeah, I mean, you can't do that. So where do we soberly, pardon the pun, but soberly consider the things? You know, when Bill died, or when he wrote Traditions, he said, I think the time has come for this fellowship to govern itself instead of having two benefactors to govern itself. He said, as long as we do these principles and studiously avoid these mistakes, we'll do well. Well, I would suggest to you that we're drifting pretty mightily away from the admonition of Bill Wilson. And so it is a big concern to me. If you look at the average group, you're not going to find, it's going to be one legacy. 99.9% of the time, it's going to be recovery, and it's going to be pretty much me and my problem type of orientation. It's going to be about recovery. And it may be a healthy thing about recovery, but you'd be pretty hard-pressed to find a time when traditions or the service work or the quality of our representation or the selection of a GSR, be hard-pressed to find that. And so when you look at that, you've got to reckon with, so what about our future? What is it that assures the well-being that a healthy program of Alcoholics Anonymous is going to be here? I hope that you're concerned about that. I hope very much. Nobody can make you be. But if you really mean it when you say that you want to be helpful to other alcoholics, sometimes we have to go beyond just what's immediately in front of us. If you really mean that. When you really say that you want to be of maximum service, you got to think of more than just what I put my hands on. I have to recognize, and I do, that my group is a part of my identity. It's not just a place I go. It's my most fundamental commitment in Alcoholics Anonymous. My group meets twice a week, closed meetings on Monday night, open speaker on Thursday night, and those are commitments. Those are not under the heading of nice to do. Those are under the heading of gonna do. And unless there is some major league kind of commitment or I've agreed to do something that I really thought was a more important service on a given night, that's where you're going to find me. I'll add this one little caveat to that. Because just like everybody else, I've got a family and all that kind of stuff. And those commitments, while they're pretty adamant in their nature, they're very important in my family. Because my family knows that that's a part of who I am, and therefore they can trust me because I do what I say I'm going to do. Now, everything else is negotiable, unless I get it on the book. You know, now, if I get it on the book, it's a commitment. Coming to Cincinnati was a commitment, but it wasn't, you know, when she first called. I'll give you an example. My son is I thought he had a great future as an AA member, but he got through it, and he became a high-risk surgeon in maternal-fetal medicine. Jesus, I mean, you got to be kind of goofy to do that. But he's doing it. He thinks he loves it. So more power to him. When he finally got self-supporting through his own contributions, he came to visit one time, and he said, "Hey, Dad, I'd like to take you guys out to dinner tonight." I said, and I didn't say a word. I guess he must have seen a look or something happened. He said, "Oh, wait a minute, this is meat night." And I said, "Yeah." And he said, "Oh, okay, well, we'll do that later." But see, it was no big deal. But suppose I'd have put that in terms of, "Oh, no, son, I told Tony that I'd go to coffee with him tonight." Well, that would have been a different deal, eh? If I'm going to pull something in and make it a value judgment about what's more important, that would have been a real hurtful thing. So a commitment is an important thing because folks can trust me and they know what I'm about. It's also important to me because it gives me a foundation. That's a part of my steadiness and my strength in Alcoholics Anonymous. Because as you gathered from my conversation with Phil, a little bit, is that my home group is where I do my work. Now, this is important. What I'll do in the morning is important. But my real important work, my most important work, is what I do in my home group. That's where I troll for drunks. That's where I look for Phil coming to the door. And boy, I tell you what, if he don't want to get hugged and met, he better hide. Because I get it, I'm going to be on him big time. And that's fundamental. So the point of all that is that if I really want to be of service, I got to get beyond just me and mine and what I need. You know, it has been so long, God knows, since I've gone to a meeting with any conscious thought about what I need that I can't even come close to remembering. I just know what I go to meet for. I've got a sponsor for that. You know, what I do is to go and be of service, to be a part, to be a contributor, to find what I need. And when I do that, my God, mine's a given. I don't have to think about it. It's a given. It's a direct product. When I make old Phil welcome, I don't mean to beat you up, buddy, but you're close. When I make old Phil welcome, guess who's more welcome? Better believe it. It's a selfish program, eh? It's a selfish program. And so when we start losing the groups where that kind of experience exists, we do it at the expense of our overall work. We do it at the expense of our solidity, of our reliability. And then the whole deal of what I was talking to Jerry about is that in a more casual gathering, where you just sort of get into that sort of continuation of aftercare dialogue, you don't get into things like active service. You don't get into that kind of stuff. That little exercise I did in the beginning about, and I wasn't just playing with you, it really makes a point, I think, that about naming the historic figures that were so prominent in the development of AA. And we really do draw a blank when we try to think of a comparable list today. It's not because we've outgrown our need. It's not because of that. My God, we need cooperative relationships as desperately as we ever have. But when you're just into sort of discussion-type me and my recovery-type stuff, that doesn't occur to you. You don't think about that. And so when those days come down, those days, you know, when treatment is no longer number one access point, I really trouble about how well we will respond, how responsibly we will reach out. And so I don't know. I probably don't need to tell you anymore that it's a concern to me, and I hope it is. I hope it is to you. That old slogan, I think it emerged at the 1960 International Convention. It was, let's be friendly with our friends. When that was done, there was a stage full of our non-alcoholic friends that were there. And it was, a real high point in history. And it's a relic of the past, almost. That term is almost a relic of the past. That whole thing of actively working with people and reaching out. I'll just say one more thing about that. I only got about two more hours worth of material. I'll just say one more thing about that. One of the things that's happened in our sophisticated society is I sometimes just have to say it down home to make it plain. It's a kind of a capturing ethic that's set in our society. In terms of alcoholics. Remember that thing I mentioned early on about Abby and the court and how Roland made the plea to the court to give me this guy? That has now done a 180. Today you still have people. There you are, Jerry. I've been looking for you, boy. Jerry's so humble I couldn't even see him. But this Roland and what he did there was the way we used to do it. And if we had a judge, no judge took initiative to do it on his own until a couple AA members and a couple of just bold souls started to step out of it. But every intervention that was done was because one of us would go to the court and say, hey, don't give him a chance, give us a chance. Let's see what we can do with him. And so, but now it's 180 degrees, eh? We were talking about a drug court. You could not get a more polar opposite of what Abby and Roland did than what a drug court does, nor any other court, where they try to remand alcoholics into AA. And it's a totally different deal. Now, if you're back in, if a judge came to me, he'd literally get a standing ovation. Today, if he came into the average meeting, he would probably be either suspicious of him or angry with him or wanting to vent something with him. And so it's just done 180. And so we're not doing that kind of active outreach stuff, you know, to try to foster and develop those cooperative relationships. And that doesn't, it's gotten so dismally in the past that I've actually had people to ask me, doesn't it violate tradition if you enter into an agreement with a court or a driver's license taking outfit or a drunk doc program? You know, aren't you violating tradition? I mean, my God, we've just let it get so far removed we don't even recognize it as a viable part of 12-step work. So those things will just tend not to get done. And those capturing deals, I'll just give you a couple examples of what I'm talking about. You've got them right here. I don't know what they are. But I guarantee you, if you want to target people anywhere alcoholics hit the wall, it doesn't matter. There's a wide range of things in Cincinnati where alcoholics hit the wall. Anywhere they hit the wall and somebody deals with them is where we need to target our cooperative relationships. Because the average professional today doesn't know how to make a simple recommendation or referral to AA. You think everybody knows? Don't kid yourself. Most of them give it the same old salute that they used to 60 years ago. What do I do with this guy? So there's huge work. I'll give you this example that one night we were sitting in a committee. My home group has every service committee that exists in AA. Every one of them is working in my group right now. And one night we were sitting in the corrections workshop, and I was chairing a meeting. We got through with the agenda we had. And I said, what do you guys think about tackling those court slips things? Those things always bug me about those things. And one guy said, oh, God, Tom, you can't do anything about that. Man, they do it all over the country. And I said, yeah, I know that. Well, let's don't tackle the whole country. Let's just see if we can do it right here in our little old community. And he said, well, we can try. We won't get anywhere. But it was interesting. An interesting activity at I didn't have much of a mind. I never would sign those things. I really felt for the guy with the paper. And somehow it just seemed clumsy for me to move into an approval status with this guy. And so I'd always wimp out. You know, they'd ask me about it. Oh, no, Kathleen will take care of that. I wouldn't tell Kathleen. I'd just say, go get her. You know, I mean, if I knew she was amenable, she's got a pen, her own pen. It says Holiday Inn on it, though, I'll tell you that. But, now, that was a wimpy way to deal with that. So I said, well, let's try it. I was on a plane one day going somewhere, and I do my best writing on a plane because I'm away from phones, and the air's thin, and my mind wakes up, and so I was writing. I thought, why does that bother me so much? And you probably do the same thing if you're troubled over it. Why does it bother me so much? So I wrote down the old advantage-disadvantage thing. You know, what's the plus and what's the minus? So I wrote it on my beagle pad there, and I wanted to be open-minded, so I put down the values first. What value would anybody see in this process? Who is it going to be helpful to? So I had 10 items that were potentially helpful. 10 of them were helpful to the criminal justice person, the probation officer. All 10 of them were helpful to them. They were what you expect, paperwork, you know, you show signs of help, you know, there were a number of things. I put question marks by 3, which maybe in your wildest dream might be a little helpful to the drunk. But I didn't really believe it. That's why I put a question mark. But none were clear winners. Now, I've known the odd case, but God, I've known thousands who've gotten so aggravated they wouldn't come to AA on a bet by being harassed like that. So on the disadvantage side, I started writing, so what's the matter with this? I think I wrote 26 things, and I mean in short order. I didn't have to do any research. And they would be about what you'd think. It brands a guy. I mean, he can't come to a meeting like anybody else. When he walks in, he's a second-class citizen at the door. It might as well stamp it on his forehead, you know. And it assures that he's going to have a distorted introduction. Now, that's not what we are. We're not a compliance factory. You know, one I wrote down put words to why it troubled me. And it said, when I do that, it changes the character of the relationship I want to have with another alcoholic. The only thing I want to be to an alcoholic is another alcoholic, just like Bill and Bob. But when I take on some validating function so that I sort of arrogantly, you know, a lot of times I don't even look at the guy. Oh, yeah, I'll sign that for you. You know, patronizing junk. I just think it's just a terribly, terribly, potentially hurtful thing. And so it was Bobby. So I wrote down, I think, 26. And I edited it down to 20. So we went in and started to meet with the fellow that we decided to meet with the head of probation rather than the judge. And he was a little, just like any kind of agency guy, he was a little defensive. You know, and he thought we were attacking him. And then when he caught on, we weren't attacking him. We were just talking shop. And so he started looking at that list, handwritten. I didn't have time to get it typed. It was handwritten from an airplane. No, I got my wife to rewrite it so she'd have a little piece of the action. She's Al-Anon, very helpful girl. Plus, he couldn't read about it. He got down to that one that I just described about why I wouldn't sign him, and he said, well, I'll be damned. I never thought of that. I said, me either. And he said, well, what do you think we ought to do? Now, my note, I'm telling you a little bit about this in case you want to jump on something. I know Jerry's got some concerns in this area. He said, well, what do we do about it? And I said, when I'm going to criticize something, I'm going to have a solution at the same time. I never attack anything that I'm not prepared to offer a solution. So he said, well, what do you think we ought to do? I said, funny you should ask. And so we'd put down four things that we thought would be possibilities. One of them simple. I can't remember the other three, but the one of them was real simple. Was do a 180 on him. Let the guy tell you what he's going to do. Instead of you telling him what he's going to do and having him prove it, turn it around. Let him sell you. That's what they decided to do. Then they asked us to meet with all probation staff. There hadn't been a piece of paper in my group since. So some of these things that you think are carved in stone, the missing element is us stepping forward and say, hey, guy, we may have a better plan. And that works better for everybody. One of our members, anyway, just last week, one of our members said, Tom, we got to do some more stuff at that probation. One of the officers told me the other day, said we needed to just visit them some. So that thing's cracking. Yeah. One other, and I'll just mention this, that we're working on right now. We've done some stuff with judges and things. I've got a real interest in the drunk. They got a fancy name for this, but I just call it the drunk lawyer program, where they capture lawyers. And I did some work with them. I did some little workshop stuff, and I spoke at their convention one time, the lawyers and stuff. And I had dinner with the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court of North Carolina and a couple of other justices. And when I got up to speak, I knew the Chief Justice professionally, but I didn't know him. I never had sentenced me, but he didn't know the intimate details of me. And so I got up, and they basically wanted me to tell my story, and I did. And I started out, I said, it's a real privilege having dinner with the Chief Justice and these other folk tonight, and all you guys. I said, if I'd have had dinner with him a few years back, it would have been for my last meal. And he caught on what I was talking about when I told the story. But I was fascinated by that because one of the things, and I'm going to flesh this out just a little bit, because I'd love to see you spring into action on something. And it'd be about the same kind of a drill anywhere. What happened, and I'd really listened closely. I was listening for any signs of optimism and heard none. You know, my perception was that the lawyers got so lost in this maze of trying to get from captivity and follow-up and monitoring into recovery that was their own, that they got lost in it. And for good reason. You know, that, I tell you what, put one of the things put me onto it. I sponsored a doc, and one night I was talking to him, and he looked at his wife. He said, oh, geez, I got to go. He called the name of another doc that he was sponsored. He said, I got to run and see him. And I said, what for? It was 10 o'clock at night. He said, I've got to take a sample. I said, you got a what? He said, take a sample. I said, no, you don't have to take a sample. And he said, well, yes, I do. I mean, he's under mandate from the medical bunch himself. And he said, my God, yes, I do. They've told me I have got to monitor this guy. I said, well, I tell you what you do. You call them or write them and tell them that you cannot take samples. And he said, well, what will I tell them? I said, tell them your sponsor said you can't take samples. So he did, and he doesn't. And the other doc, by the way, was at a meeting Thursday night. He's doing okay. But you see the bind that puts in? Well, how the hell are you going to be a sponsor and a monitor and taking salary? That's goofy. I mean, those are totally contradictory positions. But that's what happens. These aren't done by ill-intended people. These things are done by well-intended people. They're doing the best they know how. Because what you and I understand about what it takes to enlist a person into recovery in AA, they haven't a clue about that. And the reason they're ignorant is because, by and large, we have not bothered to say, hey, can we be of help? And all you're trying to do is figure out, instead of a gray maze to get through, how can we move in and cooperate so we can help with a sensible transition? Ran into the guy that directs those. He's an Al-Anon, by the way. Al-Anon guy that directs that program in North Carolina. I knew him a little bit. So I did some stuff for him. But ran into him one day, and he asked me what was I doing. I told him. I said, by the way, there's one thing I'm working on a little bit you might be interested in. And so I told him a little bit about what I've just told you, about my concerns in that area. And he said, well, what are you going to do? I said, let me just get you to think with me about something. Suppose we took a table and we sat down a bunch of you guys on that side and a bunch of us guys on that side and just kind of reasoned together. You suppose we could work out some kind of... He said, man, that's great. Just be sure I got a seat at that table. Yeah. See what I'm talking about? A simple little thing. I mean, it's not rocket science. It's not about trying to take on thing and understand the legal profession. I couldn't care less. I had more of the legal profession than I cared for. I have no interest in that whatsoever. All of these programs that are well-intended but futile in effectiveness because of these kind of compromising features are well-intended. You know, but there are places where the missing quotient is us. It's us. Failing to step forward and actively carry this message. It doesn't say we wait till they come in the door and then we tell them about it. It says we carry this message. And failing to do that, I think, is part of the stuff that's very, very difficult to deal with. I have a clue about time. I don't know if I'm going to deal with any good news or not. I'm kind of in a bad mood today. There's a lot of stuff happening. Well, I'll tell you one other real negative thing. That is negative to me. If you go back to that thing that Bill said about what will assure the steadiness of our future, It kind of reflect off that a little bit. How we do business, theoretically, is we're a grassroots-driven fellowship. Do you know that? The inverted triangle, eh? That the real power in AA is among the groups. And that what will keep us steady and strong and congruent with the needs of the alcoholic is a grassroots-driven thing. That's why we say that the GSR is the most important person, because that's the link to the fellowship. And without a viable GSR function, there's no link. And so what you got is a bunch of free-floating drunks over here that have no relationship to the fellowship in terms of how you do business. Why is that a problem? I just finished an area of chairmanship of a committee a year or two ago. We get about 21% representation when we make our important decisions, about 20 or 21%. 25 on a real boom season. Is that a grassroots-driven fellowship? That's a minority opinion at best, at best. So when you think about the important issues that confront us in AA, we wind up with, thank God we've got a dedicated group of people who are prepared to take up our slack. I was doing a little deal up by New York City over in Jersey, just across from New York City, and the chairman of the Board of Trustees, a nice man, did a little something on concept, and I did something. At a break, I went over to him, and he's the guy that's almost like our voluntary general manager of the world. You know, he's a real leader in serving. And I went over to him, and I told him, I said, let me just run something by with you. So I laid it a little bit out of just my concerns. I didn't have to explain a lot because he knew what I was talking about. I said, what I'm hoping you'll tell me is that you have a different view of this. I want you to tell me you have a different view. For God's sakes, throw me a bone, man. And he said, I wish I could, but I see the same thing. Well, what concerns me is how many people see the same thing and do nothing. Yeah. If you see the problem, I think the deal is to step forward, not back up. Yeah. And so we're lacking a lot in that business of being willing. And where do you learn that thing? If you don't have groups that deal with agendas where you get into principles and what service is about and solidify these things, naturally, you're not going to step up and say somebody needs to do something here, and so it is a huge, huge kind of a deal. Oh, that was a question. I thought, I got him. He's going to join. I'm old but quick. Well, I tell you what, we're going to have. Okay, all right. Yeah, the captain, I think, mandatory AA. We got a lot of that. Just a part of that thing, and we set up a meeting just a while back at a prison, and when we set up a meeting at a prison, when I've got anything to do with it, we meet number one with the head of that facility, not his deputy or her deputy. We meet with the number one person, or we don't meet. Simple as that. And because if you don't get the top person it bought in, then he becomes a question mark. And so we just don't want question mark. So that makes everybody else uncomfortable how to deal. So we did. I always tell them that the meeting will be short. And it'll be the only one we have unless something goes wrong. And so we go at it. And during the course of our meeting, we only plan 1 hour. That's the most I ever plan. And they wouldn't let me quit at the end of an hour. We got talking about mandatory meetings. A guy told me they had a therapeutic community there, which is a type of a treatment program, and it's kind of a boot camp type of deal. He said, those fellows, everything they do is mandatory. And he said, how are you guys going to get along? I said, oh, that's cool. We'll get along fine. We'll be good neighbors. Mm-hmm. And he said, suppose they want to come to the meeting. I said, it'd be fine as long as they ain't marching. But if they're marched in, we won't be good neighbors. And he said, all right, well, we won't be doing that then. And so, they were really intrigued with why I felt so strongly about that. And I put it to you in simple terms. When you make it mandatory, you guarantee failure. You can pretty well say that across the board. Now, certainly you'll get a notable exception, but you can bet that's what it is. You can bet that's what it is. And so we don't do that. The thing that I guess maybe I would like to I share two more experience one experience and then just one sort of a philosophical base, I guess, that we can do the ruffles and flourishes around that. I want to give you one other example on a court thing. You probably got some here. I won't ask you, but you probably got some kind of a march-in type of place that you're worried about. They, I'd give you just throw in this little example. I took my wife down to I said, you normally I'm doing something when we go somewhere, she goes with me. I just decided, I said, would you just like to go down to, she never had seen Disney World. Me either. I said, you want to go down that thing and just do nothing, just goof off for 3 or 4 days? She said, yeah, I'd love that. I said, all right, good. And so I wanted her to get a set of those rat ears that they wear down there. And I tell you, I got them. The old girl looked pretty good in them, particularly with nothing else on. She looked good. She, girl. But we did. Oh, God, I forgot we're taping. She probably said my wife. Well, she did look good. I wanted to go to a meeting, so I just called up the office and said, in meeting out this way? And said, yeah, there's one real close to you. Told me how to get there. Went over. Weird kind of a deal. I pulled up beside it, and there was one guy sitting out by the back door, and I just looked out, and he said, yeah, this is it. And I said, all right, good. So we went in, and we determined it was open, and so we went in. He was the only guy there. And then about 2 minutes till 8, it looked like a line of ducks coming in. There was this line of people came in, and I thought, what on earth is this? You know, they're like they're marching to the guillotine or something. And so he started meeting, and he read something, and then he got me to read something. And then we went for a few minutes, and he said, Tom, you probably noticed this is not your regular meeting. I said, well, I had noticed a little peculiarity. And he said, well, this is a mandatory meeting. Yeah, these folks all on probation, they just left the probation office, which was next door. And so that's why they were so happy. And now you talk about Grim City. And so, now, I still got a little bit of, just a little bit of gray matter left. And I knew there wasn't no point in haranguing these people. And so I said, man alive, I'm glad to see you guys. I've been worried for a long time about whether doing what you guys are doing is effective or not. Does it really do anything? And so tell me what you think. Well, God Almighty, you talk about a lively meeting. Man, they just came out of the seat. Well, there were no positives. I guess you know that. And so you offered us a product. And I thought, in fact, I asked you, I said, why are you doing this? You know, there you go. Why are you doing this? Good God. It was just a pointless deal. So what do you do in a deal? I'll give you one example that I ran into it out in Colorado, that a fellow, old crusty old boy named Truman, a nice guy. Crusty, though, God knows, he's like George Patton with age. He just is a really run-down guy, but he is tough as nails and good guy. He told me, in fact, they had three judges on Saturday morning sitting at the conference. And I thought, these guys got to be on house arrest or something. And you don't get judges out on Saturday morning. He had three of them sitting there. And so they started telling me about it, too. And what they do, and it's the most real profound things are simple. And what they do in Colorado Springs, they wanted to set up a program. And when they got through with the program, what they had was, they do a meeting. They do a mandatory show-up meeting that's not an AA meeting. On the given night, the probation people supervise the showing up of the people. And they set a door right out, a chair right outside the door. So when somebody comes in, check off. Kathleen's here. Check them off. They go in, and then Truman and a couple of other folks say, okay, guys, you've just left your probation. We have nothing to do with that. You know, what we're going to do is tell you about AA. That's what they've asked us to do. We'll tell you about AA. And everything that's done inside that door is done by AA members. They serve some coffee. They pay for it. They provide literature. They pay for it. They conduct that meeting. They've got an absolute policy that if the probation person, the AA member, doesn't show up, there'll be no meeting. There'll be no, the probation guy's not going to come in there and wing it and read a pamphlet to him. There'll be no meeting. That has never happened. There's always been somebody. If the probation person, which has happened a couple of times, doesn't show up, one of the guys will go to the door and say, sorry, fellas, there's no meeting tonight. Now, that is profoundly important. That sounds simple. But what happens when you start to getting affiliated is when you start losing those lines between what is and what isn't. And so that's been an eminently successful program. And it's so simple you wouldn't believe it. It's almost remedial. A guy sponsored out in Oklahoma wanted to do it, and that's where I sent him. He went over there and sat in on a session, and they started one 2 weeks ago in Oklahoma City, model after that. So it's a simple thing. And if anybody wants any information on like that, Carol's got my email, and you're welcome to contact me, and I'd be glad to put you in touch with Colorado or whatever. See you one we've got on the court slip stuff. Last thing I want to just mention here is this thing of I got at it a little bit here, but I want to just kind of close up on this again. If you look at the steps, you know, the way I like to look at it, I break them down. The first three is about surrender, and that's that foundation. Like Bev was talking about the spiritual foundation. I like to look at those first three steps as the real foundation from whence recovery grows. And then the next four through seven are essentially about, you know, really understanding what my alcoholism is about and starting to open those doors a little bit. And then the rest of the eight and nine, of course, are they're the restoration, the freedom steps at eight and nine. Then we get to ten. And there's a line in here that you rarely hear talked about much, but I'd like to just draw your attention to it. In the middle of the page down here, right after the start of step 10, it says, we have entered the world of the Spirit. Our next function is to grow in understanding and effectiveness. To grow in understanding and effectiveness. And you know that 10 is where it starts to put these principles to work as a way of life. To start making it a program where we can absolutely insist on enjoying life. It starts to put those principles in. And all that means to me, very simply, is that if I want to be helpful, all I got to do is take a look at a situation and try to understand. You know, understand what's the deal here. Understand what needs to be done. Because effectiveness to me is a very little used word that has vital importance. I kind of jokingly referred to the fact that when we do something one time, it becomes a sacred tradition. That is much more true than false. It doesn't matter whether it works or not. I did a program in Princeton, New Jersey. Okay. I did a program one day in Princeton, New Jersey, in a very enlightened community. It's the home of Princeton University. It's a few folks had started a program up there to deal with folks like I'm talking about, kind of captured a bunch. And so they set up a meeting so they could give them a royal welcome when they came into the program. I was chatting with a couple of guys before the meeting. I said, well, how do you think this is working? And one of them said, well, it's fine. Yeah, it's fine, man. We've been going 11 years. And the other guy said, well, what do you mean by that? How's it going? I said, are you seeing people show up in recovery? Yeah, are you seeing people who show up in the group? They looked at each other, and one guy said, you know anybody? The other guy said, no, do you? Come on. I don't know. I don't care what you're selling. If you can't make a sale in 11 years, it may be time to take a look at what you're selling. Yeah, something wrong, man. You know, that effectiveness, we don't look at that very much. We just sort of do stuff because it's the way it's done. A lot of times you go into a town and say, why do you do it that way? I say, well, it's the way it was when I got here. Yeah, sacred tradition. And so when it comes to doing effectiveness, I'll give you this last example. At same prison I was talking about a little earlier, they got in a new population, they wanted to set up something, went over, met with them, went through the management drill. And then we got to looking. Now, I've got effectiveness on my mind. My belief is that a program has to fit the environment it's going to serve. Me making up a program before I even see it is silly. I've got to know what I'm dealing with before I can know what tools to use. But we don't often do that. We'll just decide what kind of program we're going to have and just go and lay it on them, you know, see what happens. So I decided to do something I never had done. So I pulled the guys together, and I said, let's take a look at this thing. So we asked the management group, who's going to be here? All right, there's going to be about 300 guys, maybe a little over. Mostly young guys. They're going to be from 19 to under 25. Well, it tells us the demographic. That's one important demographic. This is going to be a young group. How long are they going to be there? About 6 months. You know, what do they look like? You know, just the usual kind of stuff to get a picture of what's there. You know, what's your schedule like? All that. So when we left, we understood what that environment was. We understood what the population was. So what we wanted to know was exactly that. It's like diagnosing a patient before you do surgery. And so we left there. We had plenty of information. So we pulled our little bunch together and said, okay, let's take a look at that and see what we can do. 6 months sound like a pretty good chunk of time, eh? It means 24 meetings. What can you do in 24 meetings that's going to be effective? What's really critically important to get across? What we wound up with in responding to what we thought was effective, and we've just finished our first cycle of it, we decided to target two things. One was a genuine first step. If you don't do a genuine first step, the rest of it is philosophy 101. And means little to nothing. Our program is based on surrender. And so I don't care if we didn't get anything but that done, as long as we can get that done. If we don't get that done, thump it up. So we wanted to get that done. We also wanted to get a working knowledge of the program. A lot of people say somebody like in jails, I hear it all the time, they're all right, they've already been to AA. Been to AA doesn't assure any learning. A lot of people stay here just long enough to get confused, you know, and then leave with, absolutely no idea what AA is. And so we wanted to have a working knowledge, not like we did with history today, but we want a working knowledge about what is it that shapes this program? What is it that's critical to its work? And so we talk about groups and meetings and sponsorship and slogans and all of the things that we use to have a working knowledge so that it's not just go to AA and see what happens. You know, working knowledge. And then the third thing was speakers. We had eight meetings of each. We want eight speakers. Because I don't think there's anything that has more power than one alcoholic bearing his soul to another alcoholic. So that's just a simple little sketch of something that we're not inclined to do much. You know, so trouble with history, you bet I am. Trouble with our terrain at the moment, you bet I am. Giving up, you bet I'm not. And I hope you don't either. I hope if you got stuff that worries you, move in on that sucker. Do something, man. And watch what happens. Thanks. Yeah, Al, you had a question? Let me take off on that a little bit. I'll try to repeat that, Al. What Al's talking about is certainly the impact of having mandatory meetings be unsuccessful in terms of the guy. And he's wanting to talk a little bit more about what's the impact on the group. My experience has been that it's no real impact. It's not a negative impact so much. It does something to the climate. It does something to the climate of the group. It contributes to that kind of practices of not giving good, warm welcomes to people. And so I think it creates a climate in that of a sort of an edge of negativity. And for each one of us who avoids doing it or who criticizes it being done, I think we pay a little price in that, in our spiritual condition. So I think there is a loss to the group. I tell you, one of the most crude things I've seen, I won't name the city, but I was in a city, it wasn't this one. But I was in a city a while back that's historically important in AA, and we went to a club, that big building thing, a very nice place, and there was a big sign posted on the door, out on front. We do not sign papers. I thought, where the hell is welcome? You know, I mean, that's normally what say is welcome when you got an open thing. But I thought, boy, that says a lot more about the person reading the sign, the person who wrote the sign, than it does the person reading it. That's exactly what I'm talking about, is that when you get that kind of a negative attitude, it's going to be hard to define who the pure one is that comes in. And so I just think it breeds some intolerance and impatience with us that we can't afford, that hardens us up, where we need to be recognizing that, just like Phil, I understand that I need him more than he needs me. I don't care where he came from. That's his business. Yeah. Anybody else? Yeah. Jeanette, yeah. Jeanette's asking about men going into women's institutions and women going into men's. I'm all for it with some precautions. Personally, the thing I look for that, and I don't want to run risk of getting in trouble with this, but I'm not a sexist, but I'm a realist. And in recovery, some women have a little trouble adjusting to appropriate kinds of relationship with men. Most have had some troubling relationships with men. And so very often you'll see somebody who deals with that in a sort of provocative, sexually oriented type of behavior. And you just got to watch for that. If a lady who goes in there and handles herself like a lady will absolutely, have a good experience. But somebody who is still a little uncertain about how to relate or getting over some wounds, or some they're sitting duck. Well, let me come back to that one. I think one of the cruelest things I've seen was about a year ago. There was not only cruel, it was stupid. But I went up the other end of the state, speaking of prison, and a young lady picked up a 60-day chip in a medium custody male penitentiary. And I thought, God, how stupid can you get? I mean, for God's sake, come on, man. I mean, that is a terrible experience for that lady and for those people. You know, when somebody comes into a penitentiary, they think you're Bill Wilson or Lois Wilson. You know, and it was just off the wall. You know, and so I really think there's a very important thing for careful, thoughtful timing. And then, I don't care what the history is, if there's a good, solid presence in the program and those kinds of personal issues are quieted down, then that can do great work. I mean, there's some fine. We've got one woman who's been sponsoring a medium custody male prison for 25 years, and her husband carries her sword. That's just about the way it works, too. It's a little different standard with it doesn't sound fair, but from my standpoint, it's a little different standard with women into male facilities than it is men into female. It's just different. And I would never myself, I had a women's prison one time when I was supervising stuff, but I would never go into a female facility without a female being with me. And my staff knew that when I was working around one of them, that they better not let me get isolated with a female. And that's for my protection. You know, there's a little different standard to that thing. It just has to do with that male-female relationship thing. And I've seen staff fired on both genders, you know, staff who work there. But men will get into trouble in a female facility more than females will in a male. And so it's just a strange deal. I'll give you one just story that, not a long story, but just a headline that shows you what happens if you don't watch about having good, stable members in going into these facilities. Well, I'll tell you the city of Montreal. The city of Montreal is a great city, but it's surrounded by seven penitentiaries. It's just like the walls of the city almost, and they're just scattered around Montreal. AA was kicked out of six of the seven. And what happened, a bunch of a female, sort of a feminist agenda, started taking on a social cause and calling it AA. And they wound up with some pretty bizarre kinds of situations. And AA was, they weren't asked to leave, they were told to leave six out of seven facilities. And so that preparation, the readiness, the solidity is critically important. I don't like to take anybody, I don't care who it is, I don't like to take anybody into a facility until they've got a minimum of 6 months, and that would be with a sponsor. I wouldn't let anybody go in under a year on their own to where they're going to take a responsibility. Now, that's strange for me to say because I went in 2 weeks after I was released. It doesn't mean I'm a superstar hero in it, but it's just back in those days, I mean, hell, we had the wounded on the firing line. I mean, and so it's a little different standard now. So I do think it's an awfully important deal with the readiness to carry the message. Yeah, Clara. Yeah, what she's asking about is just my own personal take on clubs. I'm an expert on it because we don't have one in my community, so naturally I'm an expert. I have been involved in clubs. I was on the board of one in Charlotte for a while, and I tell you, it's a tricky kind of an environment. The I'm always a little bit nervous when we get into property kind of stuff. We've got a lot of places that rent space just to conduct the aiming. When that happens, the primary purpose becomes pay to rent. Yeah. And so when you're so caught up in just the survival of keeping the facility, that becomes your focus, you know. And so I've got some concern about that because it really puts an inordinate weight on that kind of a responsibility. I'm a little concerned because of the hangout nature. I mean, that's part of it, but it just gets to be the hangout nature. Long time ago, when I was on the board of the one in Charlotte, I'll tell you the kind of thing that happened. We had a little problem. It wasn't a little problem. We had a big problem come up in Charlotte where women who were calling in for help, and we got all of our 12-step calls directly then. You know, that was predated treatment. The club fellow that answered the phone would write down the name and the address and the phone number. Well, we started getting feedback about folks going out and taking advantage of the person that called for help. Well, that's a hell of an introduction to what's called Alcoholics Anonymous. So that was caused a lot of trouble. And we're not the police force, you know, but obviously that was something that was hugely damaging to the welfare of everybody involved. So we just started monitoring the stuff. And what it was a guy that I knew well. I mean, he really knew him well, and he had good vision. So when somebody would write down an address, it takes a while back then, it still does, takes a while to find a woman ready to go out on a 12-step call. And so he would write down the address and go make the call. And then when somebody else came back, they were dealing with a victim rather than an alcoholic. And so it took a while to do that. But that's, so you get a lot of stuff that can happen. Sometimes you'll see clubs that work very well, but they have got to be managed well, and if they turn in to I'll just tell you one other city. I won't call the name of this one, but I'll tell you one other city where the old original club, the original place in that city, is barely surviving. And it's surviving because the last time I talked to any of them, there were five or six of the original board who refused to give up. But they also refused to go to meetings there because rather than being a good place for meeting, it was aggressively taken over by people who were not AA members by definition. Well, they might have called themselves AA members. But these were people who just flatly defied tradition and said that they weren't going to abide by that stuff. And so what's happened, they're protecting the legend, but it's living on borrowed time. Yeah. So you got all kinds of stuff that can happen, and I think our tradition says it very well that in that sixth tradition that we don't it doesn't say don't have clubs, but they are a separate entity from Alcoholics Anonymous. They are a separate entity, and that tradition says that we ought not to endorse, finance, or lend the AA name to any related facility or outside enterprise. And then the real key is less problems of money, property, and prestige divert us from our purpose. And so that's what happens. You know, if they're not extremely well managed, they'll get so caught up in dealing with these ongoing problems, the economic support, that the primary purpose really gets into some difficulty. So they're a real challenge. They're a real challenge. I just say one other thing about it. In my little old town, I'm not a member of it. I used to be, but there's a building in every community in America, I think, back in the Second World War, under the some program, WPA, they built these community buildings all over the country. And they served their purpose, and then a lot of them became abandoned. And one in our little community was abandoned. And the guys said, sorry, I was not there when AA started in that town, but the guys that started, and I knew them all, they started it, went to the city and asked if they could take the building if they renovated it. And that was a huge job. So the city said, well, yeah, we're not going to use the thing. And they got it for $1 a year. Well, now, if you really want to split an infinitive, you could say that that meant we were paying our way. It might push it a little. And so we became proprietors and by renters of a building by $1 a year. Worked out fine till something broke. And then guess what happened? The city's building had a problem, not us. So, you see, what we've done for the last 40 years is tap dance around the tradition. And that's what so often happens is we can rationalize our way around anything, and that's what we've done is rationalize our way around that. So that's a tough issue. It really is. They're very legitimate. They're written about in AA literature. And bottom line, what I'm saying is that my experience has been that unless they are really well managed by thoughtful, conscientious people, they're going to get in a lot of trouble. But, yeah. Well, she's asking about the towns where mine would be a good example of that, where you've got a lot of little meetings around town. In a little town, of our collective population is probably not 20,000, and we've got at least 30 meetings a week. But how many groups? One. There is no way to do it. I do want to turn it into a tradition meeting, because that's where it's at. It says that every group's autonomous. You know, that every group can function as they wish. And we've got the most liberal definition of a group that could possibly be. So you're a group if you say you are. There's no quality control agent that says, no, you don't qualify. And so the group's autonomous except what? When it affects other groups or AA as a whole. You know, I have the impression a lot of times that I was over at a group one night at a different time, not my group, and they were doing one of these nose counts. You know, I don't think we have a clue how many members we got, because what they do is just when a poll comes out, it says, everybody consider themselves a member of this group. Well, I'm sitting there with people, they're people from my own group, members of my own group, stuck their hand up. I'm the only guy in the room that didn't stick his hand up. And a guy beside me said, why didn't you stick your hand up? You come here. I said, I don't belong here. This is not my group. And I've had the distinct impression that if we rang a great big bell in my community and said, everybody report to your home group, we'd have empty halls. Yeah? Because what we created is a kind of a nomadic society that just sort of drifts around. You heard old Muhammad Ali's float like a butterfly, sting like a bee. That's what a lot of our membership does. They kind of just float from one little place to another, suck a little pollen, and then go somewhere else, you know. And so it's free to do that. Free to do that. Every member's autonomous, too. But, my God, when you pose a question like that, you can see the challenge, because we've got no police force, we've got no quality control, we've got no way of what I've done personally for the last, God, at least 25 years, maybe 30. And the best I could tell, I am really not just headstrong about it. I'm some of that. I like to think I'm dedicated. Most people think I'm obstinate. But either way, when I've gone into a town, every time I've moved, you always have that kind of out-of-the-groove discomfort. You know, you're out of your familiar group. So every time I've done that, I've looked around and tried to find a group. A lot of times, this one I'd like to just plug in and relax a while, you know, because I'm always so high energy. But for the last 25 or maybe 30 years, I have never been able to find a group that gave me the kind of base that I need to operate from. I don't mean to get what I need, but that I need to operate from.
because my group is a major tool. And if I get into a group that I just won't stay, and it's not anger, it's just that I can't do my work without tools, and my group is my tool. And so what I've had to do in every town is start a new group. And that's been in every town that I've been in for the last 25, 30 years. The one we're in right now, I'll just tell you real quick how we started that, and it's part of what I'm going to send to them, is we started a group. I was taking a bunch of guys through the big book, you know, doing a big intensive big book workshop. When you get through with something like that, you have some really pumped up people. I mean, they are really pumped up. Well, what I was running into was that they weren't all in my group. Sometimes they were pumped up and had nowhere to go. And so they started coming to me and said, man, we got to start a group for people that are getting through this stuff. And I said, well, do that. They said, well, we want you to go with us. I said, okay, but I'm the founder of the group I'm in. And then I thought it over, and I saw that group was pretty well settled in. And they really wanted to do something that had some bold feelings about it. So what we did, I just tell you this real quick. We had 10 people that wanted to do something. So we pulled them together. And it's really interesting. I'm a brainstorm guy. I know you'd never believe that, but I'm a brainstorm type of guy. I love brainstorm because, and you know what I'm talking about, is that phase where you don't think about it. You just throw it out. You know, say, what do you think? We're going to try to do this. How do you put that in motion? And then brainstorm, it means you throw out the idea. You don't have to explain it or defend it. You just put it out there. If you put it out, it goes up. So we decided to use that. Said, all right, if you want to start a group, and I chaired me. I said, if you want to start a group, what is one quality that you would insist on having in that group? If I ask you that, I guarantee you, you'd have one. Your stability would be one. You know, some sense of who really belong here. But I said, just do it. And so when you're doing that, I always say, we call it priming the pump. Or I do. You have to prime the pump, get it going, you know. So when I threw it out, we talked about it just a minute. And I threw one. I said, structure. Now, I like structure because, and I did explain it. Just said, structure. Put it up there. And then it broke loose. And when we finished in 12 minutes, we had 19 what we later started to call goals. These were the qualities we wanted in that group. And I'm going to send her a copy of that. The quality is, what is it we want to have that if we start a group, what do we want it to do? And so we laid that out. When we got through, and I didn't want just 19, so I arbitrarily put in rule 62 to make it 20. Is don't take yourself too damn seriously, you know. And we don't. We have a hoot. We said then that we wanted it to be a group that was characterized by action. And said, okay, well, how do we do that? And so what we did, we started to spell out ways that people could be active. And I forgot it was in the Third Legacy Manual, but I knew that's what governed it. I drew a circle, and we just started listing committees. And we listed 10 committees. CPC, PI, Treatment, CFC, Grapevine Literature, Newsletter. We hadn't even met. We already got a newsletter going. And then the regular officer, GSR, and all that. We got through, we had 10. And I didn't plan it this way, but I recognized it. And so we got through. Somebody said, well, where the devil are we going to get members for these committees? I said, no problem. It's already solved. What are you talking about? I said, well, I've been counting the house. We got 10 members, 10 committees. They're full. All we got to do is add members. And that's exactly what we did. Everybody took a committee. And so all at once, we're an organized group. We've got a plan of action. So we put it in action. We met. The first night we met, we had 40-some people there and never sent out a flyer or announcement. 45 people. We had a newcomer committee. The guy that was the chair of the newcomer committee one night said, we ain't getting no newcomers. And I said, why don't you start a newcomer group? And he said, you didn't understand what I said. We don't have any newcomers. I said, yeah, I understood that. Start a newcomers group. He said, well, hell, that's dumb. That's dumb. I said, well, do it anyway. Remember that bus I was talking about drove up to that place? My God, man, you let somebody know you got a newcomer group? The first night, I counted them. 41 people came to the newcomers group. We have a gang, even with treatment disappeared. We still get people because there's a hunger for that kind of thing. And so that was the way we did it. So that we not only created a fellowship we craved, but we created an instrument to bring a new energy, some new life there. And in all honesty, we have to block vote to keep from dominating our district. When we go to district, we usually over half the membership. And so we have to deliberately stack our vote against, not for us, but to push somebody else in and just to keep from dominating. But the other side of that word autonomy, we think of it as privacy and, you know, being able to do our own business. Autonomy does not mean isolation. So I think a part of how we need to evaluate is what kind of an influence are we on the groups around us? How helpful are we to the groups around us? And so I tell you that little thing about now we're more organized and more structured than the average group, but I wouldn't have it any other way. We have a marvelous time with our stuff. We really have a good time, but we do a lot of work. We have 4 prison commitments, 4 rehab and detox commitments, a CPC and PI committee, a treatment facility committee, you name it. We've got something going on. And I'm sorry? It's not a big group. We'll run, give and take, we'll run 40 to 45, somewhere in there. I mean, you build up a lot of long roster over the years, but in terms of real bodies that are drinking coffee, yeah, probably. Yeah, we get some visitors, but that's who the soldiers are. He was talking about the size there. Yeah. Anybody else? Yeah. Everybody has a job available. There are some people who insist on being spectators, but they're going to be the loser if they do, and they're not going to be real comfortable if they don't, because they're going to get hit on a regular basis. So we don't encourage the just drink coffee syndrome. But we don't make them uncomfortable. We just want to make it uncomfortable enough to do something about it, you know, and move on in. So we want to be welcome in that. By the way, those committees are not just for people who are finished products. It's a great place to put newcomers. A newcomer can lick a stamp just as good as I can. Probably got a better wet tongue than I have. So everybody can do something. They can lift a box or something, you know. So they're a great place to integrate people in the group. Paul would have done. It is tough to do. It is tough to do. I think y'all could hear what Paul was saying. That you got this sort of magnet over here that runs away some of the older, more solid type of members.
What I'm concerned about mostly is the newcomers. Because we have more meetings there than anything.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that is a troubling quality. And the reason that I mentioned it earlier, and I just reiterate it, the reason these things, these lightweight types of meetings, grow so prolifically is because they are popular. They're no strain. You know, they just go in and take what you want and leave. I mean, God, that's a strange way to treat a self-centered program, is to just look after me. But it's popular. It is a dilemma. And we have the same thing, but we're no different. You got to recognize a group like ours is not going to be attractive to everybody. A lot of people want to be where they're comfortable. They want people who are not sober enough to be dressed up and cleaned up and not cussing every other word. You know, they still want to sort of feel a little bit of that environment, not get too good too quick. And so it's a seductive environment. You know, it really is. I worry about that. We've got one in my town, and I swear to God, it is shaky would be a very kind way to put it. It is really, really more inclined to spread the disease than the recovery. But what do you do? I mean, you can't police. I'll just tell you this one thing: as far as, you know, I've got to start with me. If I want to do something about the things I'm talking about, number one, I've got to be the strongest member I'm capable of being. I want to be as well informed as I can be, so that I understand the issues and know what people are talking about and can have some kind of evaluation capability about what's wrong, right. So I want to be well informed. I want to be a good, solid group member. The other thing is I don't know of any nice way to say this. Over the years, I've found that I have simply had to part company with a lot of people, a lot of people. An awful lot of folk in AA, I'm sorry, but a lot of folks just only want to grow so far. If you want to look at the point where most of the work stops with people who are doing really trying to do recovery, take a look at Six Step, and you'll find where I believe most of the sort of the backing out of moving into to what we're talking about here will occur. And then from that point on, what happens is pretty soon on out the door. So, but when I say part company, I don't mean that I have to quit speaking to people. I'm a pretty easygoing, friendly type of guy most of the time. And so I don't put people down. But I don't hang out with somebody. You know, that I don't hang out with somebody that's not on the same wavelength. I'm not that hungry for companionship. Yeah, I had a guy I've known for years stopped me the other day in a meeting and said, "We want to talk a minute." Now he said, "I just saw somebody the other day and we was having lunch with a guy." He said, "I didn't call a name." And he said, "You know what that guy said about you?" Now I said, "No." He said, "Well, you want me to tell you?" I said, "No." And he said, "You mean you don't want to know what's wrong?" I said, "No, I really don't." And he said, "Why?" I said, "My friend, I wouldn't waste 10 seconds of my time or attention on some stupid junk like you're talking about. I mean, I don't care what it is. I have no interest whatsoever in that. Yeah, I'm not going to waste my time with that. I've got so much attention that I can give, and I'm going to be careful where I give it. And I'm not going to hang around, you know, like gossip. You know, you can soft-pedal gossip all you want to. But gossip is a tremendously destructive force, and I'm just like that example there, I'm as much a part of it if I listen to it as I am if I spread it. And so when I hear that stuff, I just don't have time for that stuff. It's not. So when I find people that just are not interested in doing anything, I'm not going to be unfriendly with them, but you can bet that that's not where I'm going to be spending my time. And so I just accept that sometimes I've just got to part company with folks. And I'll do it. I hope I don't have to, but I sure do it in a heartbeat. Yeah. Anybody else? You got? Yeah. Dave. Yeah. Well, you know, drugs got opinions on everything, but I just tell you this. Sometimes if I do a workshop on sponsorship, I don't try to tell anybody how to do it. Well, I might infer a little something, but I mean, I don't teach sponsorship. When I do a sponsorship workshop, right now the way I'm doing them, I will help the group determine what they think a sponsor, if you're looking for a sponsor, what do you want? What are you looking for? And I'm not asking you that, and I'm saying that's just one of the things. You put it, what are you looking for? How do you get it? What causes it to fail? I like to go through what is this sponsorship thing, not what does Tom Iverson think about it. But if I get a group of people, I want to get that group. They don't have to agree on everything, but I want to do brainstorming and draw out, well, what is it? See, most people, unfortunately, not, I don't know if it's most people, but an awful lot of people either wind up with a sponsor assigned to them, or they wind up with just seeing somebody in the hall and saying, "Will you sponsor me?" "Yeah, we'll give it a try." Well, I mean, that's a little too casual. If I'm going to let somebody engage in my life, you can bet there's going to be more to it than that. But see, a lot of times we treat that sponsorship too casually, and we wind up with a lot of blundering around. A bit like a medication thing. I mean, you think you want somebody that you met in the hall to advise you about medication or something? So I like to do a lot more thoughtful thing than just my own particular bias about the thing. My belief is that it's a very important personal relationship. My sponsor is the only person on this planet. I mean the only one who has unlimited access to my life. Nobody else on this planet is invited to walk into my life, but my sponsor is. Because I hired that sucker to help me stay alive, and I expect him to do that. So I put a real standard on sponsorship that the way I like to go about it is that real thoughtful kind of a way. Who sponsors who? You read it a mile away. Yeah. Anybody else? Tell you what, you guys have been just a magnificent group to work with. You're just unbelievable. And just think, I'm going to do the sunrise services and foot washing tomorrow morning. turn you back over to the president.